Faraday's Gold. Michael Faraday, the man who did the most to uncover these invisible force fields, was a curly-haired, working-class Londoner who was born in 1791, more than a century before the electron was discovered. He was exuberant as a teenager, teasing his friends with wordplay and games as they raced down the London streets, replying once to a letter from his friend Benjamin Abbott. "No, no, 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 none right. No, philosophy is not dead yet. No, no, oh no. He knows it. Thank you. 'Tis impossible. Bravo." In the above lines, dear Abbott, you have full and explicit answers to the first page of yours, dated September 28th. Even when he wrangled his way into a job as laboratory assistant at the August Royal Institution in 1813, he kept the same humor, on one memorable evening sneaking Abbott in so they could sample the nitrous oxide, laughing gas, which the director of the institution had put aside for one of his experiments. But Faraday also had a serious side, and was drawn to the same electrical puzzles that Joseph Henry sought out. How could a coiled copper wire act as a magnet and pull lumps of metal toward it? There was only empty space between the wire and the metal. Nothing in conventional science made sense of this. Hold such a live electromagnet above a nail, and the nail will fly upward. Yet the gravity of uncountable trillions of tons of rock and magma, the entire mass of the Earth, is tugging down on the nail. What pull could a magnetized coil of copper send out that would overcome that vast force? In this investigation, Faraday had one great advantage over his rivals in England and on the continent. They had all been trained in the advanced mathematics that Sir Isaac Newton had developed in the 17th century. Newton was famous for the image of a cold, clockwork universe, where planets rolled along like giant, separate billiard balls. There was no place in that universe, they were now taught, for invisible forces to fill up the space between solid objects, holding the solar system or the universe together. There were no invisible cobwebs pulling across the sky. Gravity existed, but it somehow leaped from object to object. In this view, it did not permeate the voids in between. This meant that when Faraday's contemporaries tried to understand the links between magnetism and electricity, they assumed it would have to be a force that leaped across a gap without really existing in the space within the gap. Their universe was basically empty. When forces operated, it would have to be, they believed, through the cold, distance-leaping process that Newton had labeled action at a distance. Faraday respected Newton, but he'd been supporting himself from the age of 12, for years as an apprentice bookbinder. He'd learned to think for himself. If he'd gone along with what everyone assumed, he would probably still be at the binding shop. Also, in his years as an apprentice, he'd skipped learning much mathematics beyond elementary arithmetic. This had the further advantage that he'd never been seduced by the beauty of Newton's Bach-like equations. But even if he hadn't been poor, and even if he had learned calculus, there was a further reason Faraday wouldn't have been convinced that space was empty. Faraday's family had been devout members of the gentle religious minority called the Sandemanians, a Quaker-like group with a near-literal belief in the Bible. Even as Faraday moved into the Royal Institution, he remained a devoted member. His wife was a Sandemanian, and his closest friends were as well. From his religion, Faraday was convinced that space was not empty, but that a divine presence was everywhere. He was used to being ridiculed for such beliefs. "I am of a very small and despised sect of Christians," he once sighed, and he had learned to keep his views private. But religion dominated all his thoughts, and once, on a small boat in Switzerland, Faraday saw what he took as proof of his beliefs. It was an ordinary rainbow at the base of a waterfall, but a strong wind was blowing, and the gusts often threw the spray so far to the side that the rainbow disappeared. When that happened, Faraday motioned for the guides he was with to wait. Every time, the wind blew the spray in the opposite direction, and the rainbow reappeared. "I remained motionless," Faraday wrote, "whilst the gusts and clouds of spray swept across its place and were dashed against the rock. It was, he felt, as if the rainbow were always waiting, even though it could only sometimes be seen." That was what he believed of science. Even when space seemed empty, something was there. Now, looking for a further link between electric currents and magnets, he knew to concentrate on the one thing everyone else had missed, the apparent emptiness, the voids between the different objects in his lab. He used a simple clue as the way in. A common parlor trick of the time was to sprinkle iron filings near a magnet and then watch as they form curves that stretched from one tip of the magnet to the other. To Faraday, this wasn't just a trick to amuse children. For where did the sudden arcs really come from? They were a sign, just like the rainbow, of the invisible matrix for which he'd been searching. Through 1830, and increasingly in 1831, Faraday began circling his quarry. He became fascinated by the way forces seemed able to jump from one domain to another. When clouds of gas vapor ignited, for example, it was common to say that a ball of flame instantly appeared. Faraday didn't believe that. When he stared more closely, he felt he could see the flame propel itself very quickly from one part of the vapor to another. When he went to the seashore in Hastings, a long day's coach ride from London, his wife found him kneeling on the beach to examine the ripples in the sand, pondering how they spread. It was something that Edison would never have had the time to do. By the spring of 1831, he was close, but still hadn't found what he wanted. He was 39 years old, and he hadn't come up with any significant discoveries. Had his critics been right in suggesting that he wasn't a first-rate thinker after all? Faraday cut back on his lecturing and began arriving even earlier at his lab. Occasionally, his two nieces would come downstairs to visit, but they knew they'd have to spend most of their time sitting quietly in the corner, cutting out paper shapes or playing with their dolls while Uncle Michael worked. Months passed. Colleagues wondered what was happening, and then, in work that came to a head in those pressure-soaked weeks just before 40th birthday, one of his oldest friends, Richard Phillips, received a quick note.